From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Trump says he's making good on a campaign promise. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Hundreds of recent raids and roundups are being called routine by immigration officials, but President Trump is claiming the credit. And so many people are expected to be detained that new privately run facilities may be constructed to house them. Supporters of undocumented workers who've been in the country for decades call it terrorism. Trump's backers call it shock and awe. Meantime, leaders of agriculture and other vital industries warn of a labor shortage if deportations don't prioritize real criminals and leave workers alone. On our talking point later, would banning fake news be the first step toward a ministry of truth run by the government? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To the Point. As a candidate, Donald Trump promised a deportation force, and recent roundups are creating high anxiety among millions of undocumented immigrants. We'll look at the consequences for human rights, constitutional law, and the need for labor in fields and factories and elsewhere. Today's talking point: in Europe, proposed laws against fake news could be a step toward giving governments the power to determine what's true and what's false. Sounds like George Orwell. First, this news update. After years of drought, Northern California is threatened by too much water, specifically damaged spillways for the Oroville Dam. That's the highest in the nation. Could unleash a 30-foot wall of water, and more than 100,000 people have been ordered to evacuate from the floodplains of the Feather River. Chris McGarrion is there for the Los Angeles Times. Chris, hi, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
What do you see, when you look up at that spillway?
Well, right now there is a massive amount of water coming down the original concrete paved spillway, 100,000 cubic feet per second, giant plumes of water. When you stand across the street from it, it feels like it's drizzling because the mist is floating over the river and kind of drenching everything.
There's some concern about a 30-foot wall of water if this thing lets loose. What are you doing there?
Checking it out, seeing what's going on.
Okay, well, that's what reporters do, I guess. Why should people around the country care about the Oroville Dam? How important is it to all of California and the water supply for the biggest state in the union?
Sure. So it's the tallest dam in the country. It's absolutely critical for the water infrastructure of California. It's, you know, basically a way station for water that gets all over the state. Farmers depend on it, and people who eat, you know, fruit and vegetables that grow in California, you know, they depend on water that passes through this dam.
So this could have national implications then, clearly. Governor Brown apparently has asked for an extension of a federal emergency grant he already got during the Obama administration. President Trump has not responded to that. What does that say about relations between Governor Brown and President Trump?
I think it's too soon to say right now. These emergency requests are pretty common in situations like this. I'm not sure what the usual time of reaction would be. I would note, however, that here in this area of California, this is a more conservative area of California. So if there were politics at play, that's something to consider as well.
Tell us a little bit more about what's going on here. It's not the Oroville Dam itself, which is so high.
Correct.
That is at risk. That, if it gave way, would make a 30-foot wall of water look small. So it's an emergency spillway. What has happened that caused this?
Sure. So as you said, there's three different things. There's the dam itself, which is not affected right now. You have the original paved spillway that they're currently using to drain water. Then you have the emergency spillway, which is really just the hillside. And that hillside yesterday started to erode. And because it was eroding, it was threatening to collapse part of that hillside, part of that structure there. And that could have unleashed that large amount of water. That threat is why they called the evacuation order yesterday.
So now, is this hillside then in a sense, part of the dam? Is it we're releasing water out of the dam itself?
So think of it like a bathtub, and the original spillway is kind of like that valve that lets water out of your bathtub when it gets too high. However, if the bathtub rises too quickly, it starts to spill over, and that's where kind of the emergency spillway comes in. So that's like an extra way to get water out. However, you know, because that was compromised by erosion, they haven't been able to use it, and there's no water coming over that hillside right now.
Okay, and they're looking at another big storm, as I understand it, on Wednesday, although by releasing the water they are, they're trying to lower the level. You spent the night, as I understand it, with some of the evacuees. How are they reacting to this?
A lot of them are very worried. They're not sure exactly what to do right now because they're hoping to get home. They're hoping this evacuation will end, but they're not really sure what could happen in a few days. And it's basically a race against time with the lake. They're lowering the level of the lake right now at about 3 to 4 inches per hour, but they're hoping to lower it by as much as 50 feet before the next storm hits to give them some breathing room. I'm not sure if they're going to be able to do it or not at this point.
Of course, it's been way down during the drought, and this is something new and different over the past few years. There's a lot of building, a lot of residential structures on that floodplain of the Federal River, of the Feather River, down below the dam.
Absolutely. I mean, the downtown Oroville area, where I was walking around last night, is actually below the levee. So that entire area would definitely be flooded. And then the evacuation order affected large swaths of the surrounding area downstream. So it's definitely not just an Oroville situation. You know, tens of thousands of people have received evacuation orders.
Okay, they have so far, and we don't know, obviously, what's going to be next. They are hoping for the best. I just want to thank you very much for being with us. And once again, just tell us again what you're looking at.
So right now I'm at the command center where we're looking to get some more information from state officials, and we're around the corner from the spillway where the water is pouring out of the lake.
Okay. It's a big situation, obviously, there. Very important to the state and the rest of the country as well. Chris McGarrion with the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
In a moment, President Trump says he's making good on a campaign promise on To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Olney back with To the Point. There is fear and panic among America's 11 million undocumented immigrants among reports of recent roundups by federal agents. President Trump has tweeted this: "The crackdown on illegal criminals is merely the keeping of my campaign promise. Gang members, drug dealers, and others are being removed." That's the end of the tweet. But then there is the case of Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, who has been deported to Mexico. She was deported from Arizona. That's one of six states that saw raids this weekend. And Fernanda Santos is Phoenix bureau chief for The New York Times. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, if you will, about Ms. Garcia de Reyes.
So Guadalupe, as I call her, was arrested in 2008 following a raid that was done by then-Sheriff Joe Arpaio at the water park where she worked. She was one of nine employees who were found to have used a fake Social Security number, basically used someone else's Social Security number to guarantee her employment.
Well, now, was it somebody else's or did she make it up?
You know, in her case, there were two different instances, one in which she made up a random number and a second number that was traced to a specific person. Now, could it be a coincidence that the number she made up has a match? Yes. But, you know, it's I don't know exactly how she came up with that that second number. But the point being that it wasn't a case of identity theft where somebody, you know, takes possession of somebody else's Social Security number, opens husband's like credit card accounts. She basically used that number to get her job. And she was living, she served 3 months in jail, in county jail, and followed by 3 months in immigration detention. And that was, as I said, back in 2008, 2009. And since that time, she had been going to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for periodic check-ins as part of her case, and always released and told, stay doing what you are doing, don't get in trouble with the law, come back next year. So in January, last week on Wednesday, she showed up for her first appointment since President Trump took office. And she never returned. I mean, she went into the building, and her lawyer, who walked in with her, left by himself. She was arrested during that meeting. And then she was placed in a cell within the building and taken by van to a detention facility overnight, and from that facility taken straight to the border and deported to Mexico, a country that she hadn't been to in 21 years. She was 14 years old when she was brought by her parents to the United States.
Now, she left behind two children. How old are they?
They are 14 and 16. They're both born in this country, American citizens. She also has a husband who is, like her, undocumented, and is now caring for the children. And I actually was just on the phone with someone close to her earlier this morning, and she has just arrived in her home city in the state of Guanajuato in Mexico, in central Mexico, to where her mother lives.
All right. She's sort of become the poster child for this current situation. How widespread are the raids that are taking place, and how many people like her are being picked up, as opposed to what the president said about gang members, drug dealers, and others who are dangerous people?
Well, clearly what the president said doesn't match at least this one case, and certainly many other cases. There have been hundreds of people picked up, about at least 600 people picked up in six different states, if not more, over the course of last week and this weekend. As usually happens with these raids, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have specific targets. They know they are after person X, Y, and Z who committed this and that kind of crime. But in the process, they end up picking up other people as well who don't necessarily qualify as serious felons or people with known gang affiliations or threat to public safety and national security. In the case of Ms. Reyes, Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, she was essentially by herself at an immigration agency. But we've heard reports of people picked up, being picked up after meeting with their probation officers, people being picked up in certain neighborhoods that are immigrant heavy, with agents coming to their doors. So it's been sort of like a moment where people are also, a lot of rumors are flying around, and there's a lot of time by reporters spent on checking these rumors to find out if they are true or not. Clearly, a lot of fear among people, exactly because they know that it's not just the three categories cited by President Trump on his tweet that are being targeted for it by these raids.
And Guadalupe, just to summarize what you've told us, spent 3 months in jail, 3 months in detention in 2008 for using a fake Social Security number, not an ID theft situation at all. And she has been checking in every year, as she was told to do. She voluntarily did that again this year, and she was deported.
Exactly.
Tom Sines is with us. He's president and general counsel of MALDEF. That's the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to you, to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Can you elaborate a bit more on what we've already heard from Fernando Santos of the New York Times on what's happening in all of these six other states?
Well, there's certainly a lot of questions about what is actually happening. It is quite clear that somehow there has been a change in enforcement practices from ICE and CBP. We're still trying to figure out what the facts are on the ground. But certainly, Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes' case demonstrates a change from what was common practice under the previous administration. And that certainly raises concerns for the broader immigrant community.
Here's just a quick piece of what we heard yesterday from the White House advisor, Stephen Miller, who came to explain this on ABC with George Stephanopoulos.
The executive order gives ICE officers the power to prevent crime before it happens by removing people who pose a threat to public safety and a threat to national security. I was on the phone last night with someone from DHS. They removed a gang member and a wife beater. At 4 o'clock in the morning, they arrested them. That person had been on the radar screen for a while, but they were not deemed a priority by the previous administration because they didn't have the right kinds of convictions.
So here, Tom Sainz, on the one hand, we have Guadalupe, who we described earlier, and now we have somebody described or people described as gang members and wife beaters. Should they, in fact, if they are guilty of those crimes, be deported?
I think there's a serious question about whether it makes sense from our own country's standpoint to deport folks who are unrehabilitated criminals, if in fact that is what they are. What we have seen in the past, Warren, is that our deportations of those who are convicted, and even after they've served their terms, sometimes leads to their replicating what they did criminally in this country in their own countries. That in turn contributes to conditions that, like those in Central America, drive others to leave and migrate to the United States. By the same token, what we've seen is that there are a number of folks who return to the United States despite being removed with criminal histories and who may engage in criminal conduct again. So even if, and I think it's a major question whether that's accurate or not, these are folks with serious criminal histories who are a real threat to public safety, there's a real question about whether removing them from our country is a smart move for our own country's best interest.
If we don't deport them, what about them? And particularly if they have serious criminal records, what should we do with them?
We should do what we do with folks who are similarly situated to them who are U.S. citizens, which is we should be prepared to respond if they are recidivists and go back to the same conduct, or otherwise we should make sure that their family ties, their opportunities are such that they may be convinced that they should not engage in the same conduct again. But I do want to emphasize it's not at all clear that what Miller said is accurate, that in fact these are folks who are serious threats to commit crimes again at all.
Let me go back to Fernando Santos, again, the Phoenix bureau chief for the New York Times. You've been covering this up and down the border, not just in Phoenix. Is there sentiment for the kind of thing that Tom Sainz is saying, or are people very supportive of Donald Trump, or do you find them divided?
You know, I find that the opinions run the gamut. And what's most interesting to me is that we tend to assume that if someone is Latino or if someone is specifically Mexican, that they will be that they will be against President Trump and his directives and in favor of some kind of immigration reform or my more friendly system towards the people who are here undocumented. And that's not necessarily the case. In fact, I am now, starting to work with some folks on the border to talk exactly about that. And the same way that the Latinos and Mexicans are not all against Mr. Trump, it's not necessarily true that all ranchers are conservative people in favor of these more drastic measures, because everything that's done in terms of border security and enforcement directly impacts the lives of people who live on the border. So here in Phoenix, where I am right now, it doesn't make a difference if the administration triples the number of Border Patrol agents, Immigration Customs Enforcement agents, or specifically of Border Patrol agents. They want to double the number of Border Patrol agents. But if you live on the border, it impacts your life because you see more of them on the streets. They're entitled to do roving patrols and stop people within 100 miles of the border. There are checkpoints that people have to go through within U.S. soil. So if you're leaving your border town to go to Tucson or to Phoenix, if you're heading north from the border, you're likely to go through one of these checkpoints. You have to roll down your window, sometimes show identity, sometimes be subjected to a secondary inspection, many questions, time spent. And I've covered stories about the sort of abuse that people claim that they have suffered. So, the point of all of this is that there are various different opinions, and people are conflicted because many of them do believe that We need to do something to make it much harder, if not impossible, for drug dealers in specific to come and bring loads of drugs into the United States. But on the other hand, they think about the sort of humanitarian aspect of this story, people who are leaving situations of poverty, violence, like the Central Americans or even some parts of Mexico still, and coming here, Haitians and now Cubans as well, right? But at the same time, they don't want to live surrounded by a, you know, in a military zone, which is how many of them feel.
Very complicated situation at the border, much more complicated, I think, than people who don't live at the border or visit the border really know. Mickey Kaus is with us. He's a political commentator. He's author of the book, The End of Equality. He blogs at Kaus Files. And Mickey Kaus, good to have you on our show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You have said that this is shock and awe by the Trump administration, and you're okay with that.
Well, I do think this message is not directed necessarily at people in the United States. We want people who are abroad who might think of coming here illegally, including from Latin America, but not entirely from Latin America, not to think that when they get here, they're going to be home free if they make it to the interior. And the problem with leaving people alone whose only crime is coming here illegally is that that's a magnet for millions of people abroad who say, well, if I just get past the border, they're not going to bother me the way they didn't in the Obama administration. So I do think Trump would be quite rational in trying to send a message abroad that, no, you're not home free if you come here. Anybody who's here illegally, it's like speeding. You're not always going to get a speeding ticket if you speed, but you just might get a speeding ticket. If you're here illegally, you are subject to deportation. You're here illegally, and it's probably not going to happen, but there is a risk.
What about Guadalupe, the woman we heard from initially, as opposed to the kind of person that Mr. Miller describes as having the right kinds of convictions? Guadalupe certainly wouldn't send much of a message overseas, I would think.
Well, I think it does send a big message in Guadalupe would not be my priority, but she does fit Trump's category. She was guilty of a felony. I don't think that stealing a Social Security number is a victimless crime. I don't see why it's not identity theft. If you use it to get employment and then you're owed taxes, the taxes get tracked down to the Social Security number. Some unsuspecting person who has that number will wind up with the IRS on their case. So it's not a victimless crime. And, you know, on the other hand, she has, you know, factors that weigh in her favor, including two American kids. So she would definitely not be a priority for deportation under Obama. But she's not entirely innocent either.
Fernando Santos, I don't want to get bogged down in this, but has there been any evidence of anybody having to pay taxes because Guadalupe used their security number?
Well, the Arizona Republic, which is the state newspaper here in Arizona, actually reached out to the man whose Social Security number she used to obtain employment. And this man not only said that, you know, he didn't know of any consequence, anything happening to him because of that, he had no idea that she had even used his Social Security number to obtain employment. So it appears that there was never any harm caused to others. Of course, it is a crime. It is illegal. It's a felony. There's a reason for that. And there are many people who are harmed very seriously, who go through a lot of trouble to gain their identity back, as one would say. But the distinction here, as has been made by the particulars of her case, as I said before, it's not that she was using that to gain economic gain.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation on our talking point later. Would banning fake news be the first step toward a ministry of truth run by the government? That's a question that's being raised in Europe, where new laws are being proposed. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Olney back with To The Point. Immigration raids have stepped up considerably over the past few days in six states, obviously relatively close to the border. President Trump says, yeah, I'm in fact making good on a campaign promise. I want to go back to Mickey Kaus, who has said that he is supportive of this, calls it shock and awe, directed in part at potential immigrants who are still overseas, as well as on people here in this country who might cause a problem. Mickey Kaus, are people getting what they voted for?
Well, I think they're getting most of what they voted for. The one thing he hasn't done that he promised to do is get rid of Obama's so-called Dreamer Decree or DACA Decree, which protects a certain class of people who came here when they were children or teenagers. And he is apparently vacillated because people say, well, why do you need all these cases of dreamers who were complaining that they're now subject to deportation? So he sort of let that sit. He has not reversed that order. But he's done basically everything else he can do by executive order. Other things like, mandate the E-Verify employment check system, he needs Congress to do.
Okay, let me introduce Paul Wenger. He's president of the California Farm Bureau Federation. He runs Wenger Farms in Modesto, California, grows almonds and walnuts. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
Are you concerned that you might see, and others in the agricultural industry, a shortage of labor as a result of this?
Yeah, it will. For ourselves, we're more keep our employees year-round, so we don't have the need for the larger numbers of folks when it's time to pick fresh plums, cherries, strawberries, cherries, whatever it is. Everything that we want to have on our plate that is usually being migrant labor or foreign labor that's coming in and doing that work. We already know that a lot of folks are concerned on some of the surprise I-9 audits and other things that crews are disappearing right at the time when harvest is ready to go. It's not a new thing. We had it 2 years ago when President Obama was there. ICE was doing some of these raids. And so anytime it happens right at the peak of harvest, it's going to mean devastation for those growers who have their crop to get in and only a few days to do that.
What's an I-9 audit?
An I-9 audit is an I-9 when somebody comes to work for you. You have to fill out an I-9 form, and so you have to look at all their identification. If the Social Security number looks legitimate, then you put it down, and so you have to be very careful. If you question a Social Security card, certainly if it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you would question it. But otherwise, if everything looks legitimate, you really have to accept that. And so that's where they come in, and ICE will sometimes come in and check those and make sure those Social Security numbers are legitimate.
Is this the so-called E-Verify system, then, that we heard about earlier from Mickey Kaus?
No, the E-Verify would be a system in place to where, as an employer, you would put that Social Security number into the system, and you would get it relatively quickly, supposedly. When E-Verify went in, or they were talking about it, and some industries utilize E-Verify in some states currently, a lot of folks that even were born in this country and had a good Social Security card were getting mismatches. Somebody put the number in wrong or whatnot. And so we have said all along that before they have an E-Verify system in place, they should have something to where folks that are here can get good documentation, get something like what happened in 1986 with IRCA, with what Ronald Reagan did. Part of the problem that we're having right now, Warren, is because we never had anything for allow, especially for folks from Mexico, to go in and get any kind of a work visa. That was going to be the second part of IRCA in 1986. They ended up with H-2A program. H-2A program is very litigious and just doesn't work, even though some folks are trying to make it work. But we never followed through. And so now maybe where we're at today, maybe we get something done. While Trump has certainly done everything that he said he was going to do, maybe the challenges out there are going to bring people to the table to figure out a system so that those folks that can pass the background check can get legal work documentation.
Let me go back to Tom Sines, the president and general counsel of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. So Paul Wenger with the California Farm Bureau Federation says maybe this will provide time for a system that is rational and makes sense and that people can, in fact, use. What do you think is the reason that this is being done right now?
I think that there is an attempt to make true on the promises that Donald Trump, the candidate, made and do it early. I think there is an interest by some inside of the White House to engage in a campaign of intimidation against immigrants, perhaps with some notion of deterring further immigration to the country. The truth is that we have seen a net zero immigration from Mexico in recent years, in fact, possibly in the negatives. So it's not clear what practical impact any such effort would have in any event. But other than that speculation, I think it's impossible to know, in part because of confusing messages sent, why this is happening right now.
Paul Wenger, back to you. Even amongst farmers who might lose labor as a result of this process, were there people who voted for Donald Trump?
Probably a lot of them. It's just very hard to say. But I would imagine across the country, you know, a lot of folks out of agriculture. And I guess, as I tell folks and some folks who I know personally that were, you know, big Trump supporters are now very worried because they have in the fresh fruit and vegetable industry. But I guess, you know, he's not your typical politician, and that's what he's doing. He's saying, hey, this is what I campaigned on. This is what I'm going to do. And so there shouldn't be any surprise with anybody, whether it's TPP, whether it's immigration, the Affordable Care Act. He's carrying out on some of the things that he said he was going to do. But we're hoping that we get through this first little barrage of the things that he wanted to say that, yes, I'm not a typical politician. Let's sit down now and try to come up with some solutions. He did say he was going to build a wall, but through that wall was going to be doors that allow people here. And as was said earlier, we're looking at a decreasing birth rate in Mexico as the Mexican economy continues to increase. We know that there's going to be fewer and fewer people who are going to look to climb the ladder of economic success by coming to the United States. They're going to be looking to stay in their own home country. So, you know, but what do we deal with the people that are here that have now put down roots after 9/11? They couldn't go back and forth across the border. They're here. They're stuck. For most part, they're Americans. Let's figure out a way to get them an adjustment of status.
Tom Steins, back to you. I indicated earlier that many of the areas where these raids have been occurring are close to the border, but that's not the only place where they are occurring. They're also occurring in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, which is closer to the border, of course, than the other two. But why do you think this is occurring in areas such as that, urbanized areas, not places like the Central Valley of California, where Mr. Wenger comes from?
Well, I think there's an effort to try to intimidate the community. And if you're engaging in these actions very publicly in urban areas, they're going to be seen by other immigrants. They're going to be seen by others in the Latino community. And the message is one designed to intimidate folks. But it's important to remember that most of these folks, unless we're talking about those with a final order of removal, have rights, should exercise those rights to have their cases heard in immigration court. Many of them will have a basis to stay here. But it does seem curious, other than a message of intimidation, to focus on the urban areas where these are going to be very public, very noticed, very reported upon.
Mickey Kaus, you said shock and awe earlier. Is that the same thing as intimidation? Is that okay? Is it a good strategy?
Well, I don't see why it's intimidation if gangbangers are removed from the community. I didn't understand Mr. Stein's argument that if they're going to commit crimes, we'd rather have them committing them here rather than abroad. Seems to me we'd rather deport them and have them commit the crimes abroad, even if indirectly that sends more immigrants back here. It's not true that immigration has stopped. Most of the figures stop at 2014, but since 2014, it's picked up from Mexico and especially from Central America. So this idea that the illegal immigration problem has gone away is just not true. And it's not intimidation to say we expect people to obey the law. If the end result of Trump is that we work out some formal program where Mr. Wenger and other employers can get a stream of guest workers who maybe then have the right to become citizens if they work for so long or something. There's certainly room for a workable program that lets in the workers Americans need. But first, we have to get control of the border.
Tom Sines, back to you. What do you say to that, particularly with regard to sending people overseas to commit crimes there? Why isn't it better to do that?
What we should be doing is making sure that folks don't commit crimes again by working to ensure that rehabilitation is actually what happens in our prisons. But I'm not sure how it makes sense or involves fairness for someone who came here as a child, as an immigrant who then engages in criminal conduct, to then send them back and, as he suggested, perhaps have them commit crimes there. But the point really is that the intimidation is not about the specifics of anyone who was removed. Let's go back to Ms. Garcia in Arizona. I'm not sure what message that sends. The fact is, engaging in street raids, engaging in armed invasions of homes is designed to intimidate others around them, whether or not they're lawful immigrants or not. Lawful immigrants also face the danger of being removed if they engage in criminal conduct of some sort. So I'm not sure what this does other than scare others when you do it so publicly in urban areas. And to go back to the notion that this intimidation somehow sends a message to potential immigrants ignores the fact that really what drives immigrants are push factors in their own country, not pull factors from this country. And every academic who studied it will tell you that. And the push factors relate to economic conditions. In fact, what Mr. Trump may do in demolishing the auto manufacturing industry in Mexico may have more to do with increasing immigration numbers than anything else. We should be attending to what's happening in sender countries, not sending some message from here, because the double danger is that that message goes out also to those who would come here as legal immigrants and who would engage in business, would engage in employment, would contribute to our society. The fact is, the message is undifferentiated, and it's a message that you potential immigrant, particularly you Latino potential immigrants, are not welcome here.
Tom Sines again with MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Paul Wenger, back to you, California Farm Bureau Federation. You sound very sympathetic to the workers who are crossing the border. You mentioned what happened in 1986 when Ronald Reagan revolutionized the situation, essentially, although part two of his plan, as you indicated, didn't take place. Do you think that there should be a path for citizenship for those who have been here, even if they've committed crimes, presumably done time and paid the price, as Guadalupe did?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, anybody that's doing a violent crime absolutely ought to be sent back. I know utilizing a Social Security number, I wouldn't account that totally to identity theft. And the interesting thing about it is a lot of folks, they put down a Social Security number, they get it made on the street corner. The person whose Social Security number doesn't even know it's being utilized. When it comes time for them to pay taxes, they can go to the government and get a taxpayer ID number for somebody without Social Security card. I mean, that's being done all the time. So the government knows where they're at because they are paying their income taxes back. And actually, under that Social Security number, somebody will have more in their Social Security account. So if they look and see how much every year is being put in, they'll know somebody probably has their number. But I don't equate it to identity theft. But yes, most Mexicans are pretty proud Mexicans. They don't necessarily want to become United States citizens. They just want a way to work here legally. And so I think the number, and not being Hispanic myself, but talking to my workers that got legal in 1986 and now became United States citizens because they were afraid the green card program would go away, and because the green card program, you have to stay in this country more than 6 months out of the year or they will take your green card away from you. Most or an awful lot of the folks that come here and work in our area, agriculture, they have businesses, they have farms in Mexico, they want to come here, they want to work 2, 3, 4 months out of the year and go home. A green card doesn't work for them because ICE says you need to be in this country more than 6 months out of the year. Give them a work visa, let them come back and forth. But they're proud Mexicans. They would much sooner stay back down in Mexico and keep their families there. But now once their families are here, they don't want to go home, and I can't really blame them.
Fernando Santos, our first guest with the New York Times, the Phoenix bureau chief, who's been covering this story up and down the border and in other places as well. It's my understanding there are reports that detention centers near the border aren't sufficient to hold all of the people who are expected to be rounded up. There are reports that Mr. Trump wants to build new ones and that they would be built operated as private facilities. What can you tell us about that?
Well, what we know for sure is that if the administration does detain all the people that it says it plans to detain, for example, people who are caught crossing the border illegally. In the past, some of them were released, others were brought to detention. Now, under President Trump, the directive is that they will all be detained. If these raids continue and some people are not immediately deported but brought to a detention center, there just are not enough beds available. The majority of detention centers are privately owned and operate on a contract with the Department of Homeland Security. Arizona has two large ones, in Eloy and Florence, and they're both privately owned. And so the idea would be to have more of these private centers built to be able to accommodate all these different people, which on one hand is a good thing because it generates construction, generates jobs, and then once the facilities are built, there will be, you know, guards that will be necessary to hire and be used for employment. So it's somewhat fulfills part of the message that Mr. Trump ran on, which is to create more jobs in this country. But then, you know, there's an enormous cost to that. And the question is, you know, what are we going to have to sacrifice to pay for all of that? But as far as I know, there are not yet any concrete plans for any specific construction in any specific location. But if, as I said, things continue as they are, it's clear that they will be necessary.
We have a very short time left. Mickey Kaus, you in favor of that?
Yes, I think, you know, one of the big magnets for people coming here from Central America was the catch and release policy, where they, you know, you come across the border, they give you a notice to appear in court, which is interpreted by the coyotes as a permission to come, and you're given a court date 2 years from now, which you can ignore. So you basically, you're home free. So ending that policy is very important in terms of deterring people from coming.
Okay, Tom Sainz, quickly back to you with Maldef. Do you think that makes sense?
No, the records of these detention centers, particularly those that are privately operated, is horrendous. We shouldn't be engaged in the business of detaining families, detaining minor children at all. We should instead ensure that we are treating them like the refugees that they are, fleeing terrible conditions in Central America.
Okay, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you all very much for helping us with this subject. We're certainly not going to resolve the differences of opinion that exist, and it is one of the major issues, of course, that Donald Trump used to become president of the United States. We'll keep talking about it as time goes on. Fernanda Santos with the New York Times, her book, The Fire Line, the story of the Granite Mountain hotshots and one of the deadliest days in American firefighting. Tom Sainz, the president and general counsel of MALDEF, Mexican-American League of Defense and Education Fund. Mickey Kaus, he's author of The End of Equality, and he blogs at Kaus Files. Paul Wenger is president of the California Farm Bureau Federation, who runs farms in Modesto, California, where he grows almonds and walnuts. Thank you all very much for being on our show. In a moment, what's worse, fake news or laws to criminalize fake news? This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here with today's talking point. The frontrunner in France's presidential campaign warned today that Russian media are threatening democracy by distributing fake news. There are similar concerns in the Netherlands and Germany. And in some countries, there have been proposals for sanctions, even prison terms, for distributing false information. Fleming Rose is a Danish journalist and senior fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He's reminded of George Orwell's dystopian novel, 1984. Fleming Rose, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you. Thank
what you. Reminds you of 1984? What part of that novel are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the Ministry of Truth in Orwell's novel, and its purpose was to dictate and protect the government's version of reality. I don't think that the government should be in the business of deciding what is true and what is false when it comes to current affairs, science, and history. And that book was banned behind the Iron Curtain because it reminded the citizens of the Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries about the society they were living in daily.
You come by this in terms of some actions of your own. You were very much involved in the Danish newspaper publication of cartoons of Muhammad that caused some controversy 10 years ago.
That's true, but that was not fake news.
How was it related?
Well, it was about free speech and self-censorship, and I'm a I try to be a consistent defender of free speech, and that's also why I have been speaking out in defense of radical Muslims' hate speech in Europe. Several European governments, including my own, have criminalized that kind of speech, and I think they should have a right to speak their mind as long as they do not incite violence.
You're suggesting that if you criminalize one kind of speech, then you give the government the power to determine what can be said and what can't.
Exactly. And that's a problem with fake news. If you go down that road, it's a slippery slope, and we don't know where it will lead us. It will probably lead us to a society that we do not want to live in. I lived in the Soviet Union. I had friends among Soviet dissidents, and the majority of them were, in fact, sent to labor camps because they, according to the Soviet government, deliberately disseminated false information about the social and political system of the Soviet Union.
What sorts of laws in what country are you the most worried about? You mentioned your own country, Denmark. What about Italy? What about Germany?
I'm not so worried right now about my own country when it comes to fake news and law initiatives. I think Germany, it's the biggest country in Western Europe, and Germany already have a lot of laws criminalizing, you know, denial of the Holocaust, all kinds of hate speech laws, and the Minister of Justice in Germany has proposed up to a 5-year prison term for people disseminating false information. I think that is very, very worrisome. And it's also on the level of the European Union. There are still 28, soon 27 members of the European Union, and the Justice Commission of the European Union has proposed, you know, similar initiatives that media, Facebook, Twitter, they should be forced to take down false information, and if they don't do it, take down fake news, and if they don't do it, they should be fined €500,000. And the interesting thing here is that the European Union and the German government, they equate hate speech with fake news. They want the same kind of sentences for disseminating false information as they do when it comes to hate speech.
Okay, well, what about what's happening in France right now, where apparently there are efforts by Russia Today, by Sputnik, and other entities connected to the Kremlin to actually influence the presidential campaign. They have hacked information and spread false stories about candidates for president, but not about Marie Le Pen, who is favored by the Kremlin. Is there something that you could do to stop that?
Absolutely, by putting out true stories. I mean, you know, we talk about fake news as if it's a whole new, brand new phenomenon. It's not. It used to be called false information, and the Soviet Union was in the same business when they supported communist parties in Western Europe. It's nothing new. The new is, of course, the digital technology that makes it possible to do this in new ways.
But what about the situation we have now, where people all over the world now are losing confidence in the truthfulness of their own governments? How do they know that one thing is true and another is not, if you don't allow some sort of sanctions to be imposed when things are demonstrably untrue?
I mean, one of the reasons why we believe in free speech in the West is because it contributes to to a process where error, where truth will out defeat error and false information, as long as we have an open space and a free exchange of information. That system has served the Western democracies quite well.
But there's more and more situations, and particularly in this country, and excuse me for interrupting you, don't have a lot of time, where people choose sources of news that are, in fact, distributing false information on their own, because that's where they want to get their information. Is that something you just have to, say, live and let live about?
No, but it's because people are looking for confirmation of their biases, because there is a growing gap between, you know, media, mainstream politicians on the one hand, and a lot of ordinary people on the other. And in Europe, at least, I know less about the United States, but in Europe, it's because a lot of mainstream politicians and a lot of established media have not been willing to tell, you know, what is going on in society, especially when it comes to immigration, Islam, and things like that. Remember January, I think it was 2016, in Cologne in Germany, where several hundred German women were harassed, sexually harassed, by immigrants or asylum seekers, and the media for a few days didn't report about it until it all exploded. And, okay. And this creates a lack of trust in the established media, and it contributes to the fact that people are looking for confirmation biases, even if it's outright lies and not fact.
So the way to combat fake news then is to sort of flood it with legitimate information, I take it, would be the
Absolutely.
Bottom line. Fleming
yes.
Rose, again, at the Cato Institute. Great to have you on our program. Thanks so much.
Nice to be with you.
I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.